Good afternoon, you're very welcome to this edition of Women Today. Imagine a lively, white-haired woman, an active person who doesn't look her 80 or more years. A woman concerned with the niceties of life, colour, flowers, elegant teas, a gentlewoman. Imagine all that, and you'll come close to seeing Sheila Humphreys. Few meeting her for the first time would associate her with the great historic events of our time. But Sheila Humphreys was involved in these, and very deeply, particularly in the struggle for Irish independence.
Well, of course, the family was always involved. I mean, I can't remember any time that I wasn't interested in the freedom of Ireland or anything, because my people were all involved in it. So it was really no credit to me to get interested in it.
And your uncle was the Oireachtas?
Yes, yes. And he was killed in 1916.
Did that have a big impact on your family?
Oh, yes. Oh, naturally it did. On all the Republican families it had an impact, because they used to meet only the month after the rising. There was a mass, commemoration mass for all the people who died in 1916, and all the families would meet each other at that, and that went on for months. In all the different churches, Clarendon Street and Whitefriar Street and Mount Argus, where they all met.
So Sheila Humphreys' family was steeped in republicanism. They lived in Dublin 4, and their politics was unusual for the area. Their neighbours had little sympathy for the Humphreys' republicanism.
They were very opposite. They were all on the side of the British. They all had their fathers or brothers or uncles fighting for England, you know. And they looked on us as completely queer creatures living in the thing. And, of course, we were sorry. We thought we were the people, not they. We were pitiful. We had a pity for them.
So you were unusual in your own neighbourhood, and your brothers went to St. Enda's.
My elder brother went to St. Enda's. The younger one was, he was too young that time. And he was out in 1916 too. Though, actually, my mother went down on Easter Monday evening to try and bring him home, because she felt, you see, my father was dead, and if anything happened O'Rahilly, well, they'd be left without a father too, and they were only our two families were very close to each other, you see. But she came back without him.
He wouldn't come with her?
No, but she went again on Tuesday.
Where was he?
In the GPO.
In the GPO.
She went again on Tuesday night, and this time she went over to the Colettine Convent and collected medals of Our Lady of Perpetual Succour and leaflets also. They were called Our Lady's Shield, the Volunteer Shield, I think it was. And they had a prayer for the volunteers on this particular little tiny leaflet. And she went down armed with those and gave them to Pierce to give out, which she did, because years after we'd often meet a man and he'd say, oh, I still have the medal that I got in the GPO in 1916. So she tried again and this time Pierce called Dick side, and he said, well, I think you have showed now that you were willing to come out with us. I think you should go back with your mother.
And was he disgusted about that, your brother?
Oh, very, very altogether. And he told me years and years afterwards that he whispered to O'Rahilly, his uncle, I'll be back. But anyhow, they came back, and they had to, on the way back, we lived in Northumberland Road at the time, and on the way back, they had to come past Boland's Mills. Well, now, as everybody knows by this time, in Boland's Mills, there were no coming among, although they had waited on Mount Street Bridge to be called. And De Valera didn't approve of having girls from, I think he didn't want to put them in danger. And so there were no girls there, no women of any kind. And the result was the men found the whole situation much more difficult than if there were girls there helping them, even though you might think they're only making tea, but at least they'd be there to keep the spirit up. And a lot of them went off their heads, a number of them.
In Boland's Mill?
In Boland. Not a number now, just a few went off. And
so what contribution were the women making in 1916?
Oh, well, they were invaluable in all the other places. They were in all the other buildings that had been taken over.
But just making tea and keeping spirits up, or were they doing more?
Oh, well, there's always a lot more than that to do. I mean, Winifred Kearney from Belfast was Connolly's secretary. She acted as secretary during it, took down any messages, and Pearce also had somebody taking out. And, of course, then Pearce chose Elizabeth O'Farrell to bring the flag of surrender in the end. You know that story, how well she brought it up to General Lowe.
Well, tell us that story.
Well, he picked her out when they decided they'd have to surrender, when the roof was falling in. And they decided there was no chance, no sense in staying any longer, that they'd all be crushed by the roof and burned to death as well, that they'd have to surrender. So then he, they decided to leave the GPO first and try to get over to the forecourts or some of the other buildings which were being held. And that was when my uncle went out, was asked to leave the sortie out. And he was allowed to pick his own men, I think. I'm not sure of that now, whether the men that were to lead this particular sortie were who they were chosen by. But I know that when he saw them ready to come out with them, he said, oh my, if we're all shot down, there'll be an end to the Gaelic League, because they were nearly all Irish speakers. And, of course, they tried to get out past, crossed Henry Street first, then over into Moor Lane, but there was a blockade.
Mm.
Yeah. And they fired on them all. And there were three or four of them shot dead, including my uncle. And
the spot is still marked, isn't it?
It is. A boy, because he didn't die immediately. A boy from Ballybunion that we had known to... Mm-hmm. Called Shortus. And I think there were two other Kerrys, at least one other Kerry man, mm-hmm. shot dead at that particular spot.
So what about the actual surrender?
But then they got into a house in Parnell Street where they drew up the form of surrender. And Pearce asked Elizabeth O'Farrell, would she go up Henry Street to where the British had their temporary headquarters, General Lowe, I think it was, and she did. They gave her a white flag to carry. But when she got up then, and she had a white band on her, Red Cross band on her arm, but when she got up, I believe they said, oh, you've got to tear, we don't recognise anything. They wouldn't even recognise her as a Red Cross thing. But she gave her, yes, she said she wanted, she had a message from General Pearce. And the British commander said, there's no such person as General Pearce, but you can give me the message anyhow. So the message was about the surrender. So he said, well, we're not taking it through any intermediary. Tell Mr. Pearce that he has to come up himself. So she went back and gave the message, and Pearce went up with her again the second time. And
must have taken considerable courage for her to walk alone.
Mustn't it? But she was like that. She was a wonderful person. She wouldn't even realise that it took any courage. She was that sort. She was just single-minded. She had this job to do, and that's what she was going to do, and she didn't care if she was shot. And then she went round to all the other houses, to Boland's Mills and to Jacob's and to the Mendicity. She brought the message everywhere. I remember I did say to my... Oh, yes, my brother did come back, and he was nearly shot passing Boland's Mills because,
as I said,
the men were all kind of very nervous, and when they saw these, my mother and my brother walking along this almost deserted street, they took a pot shot at them. because when my brother got in the door, he said, you know, I was perfectly safe in the GPO if she had left me there, but I was nearly shot on the way back. But he went back next morning to the GPO.
So there was Easter week and the rising, defeat and capture of the rebels, and then the death sentences. How important was it all for the Humphreys at that time? Did what happened in 1916 actually change their attitudes?
Until then, my mother really was only interested in the piano and in gardening and looking after her family. It was after 1916 that definitely came.
Well, what happened then to your family? Well, your mother, yourself? You joined Cumann na mBan?
Oh, not immediately. I had to go back to school. And, they weren't very anxious to take me back, as the mother in charge said while my mother was in jail, that they never had any girl whose mother... Oh, she was arrested. My mother was arrested immediately after 1916, though, as I say, she'd had nothing whatever to do with it. But the soldiers came and raided the house and found a Fianna uniform belonging to my younger brother, a signalling flag, and an extraordinary thing. They were, in this way you might say, they were rather chivalrous. They allowed her sleep in her own house. But at 10 o'clock every morning, they marched her up to the RDS, which had been taken over by the British soldiers at the time, and they locked her into a horse box.
My goodness.
Where she remained for the day. And she said,
A horse box.
That was all that was in the RDS. You see the
and you say this is chivalrous. I suppose it was better than being in
Kilmainham. Bring her home. At least there was that. But they used to march her down at night, talk of the poem, and march her up, you know, the thing down. They'd march her home in the middle of the street or with soldiers on both sides. And but she said that the soldiers in the who were guarding her in the RDS, they were, and there was one so kind that he said to her one day, have you anything to eat? And he took out a bit of sticky chocolate out of his uniform pocket and handed it to her. And she said she took it because she wouldn't dream of hurting him by not pretending that she was that hungry. I don't think she was quite that hungry. But
do you think that changed her? Do you think that made her more
radical? She would have anyhow, because that was the way, the trend of things after that, you see. There was prisoners to be looked after and prisoner dependence collections made for them and all. And then, of course, my brother was sent off to England, to jail, to Wakefield. So she went over to see him there. So after that, she was as involved as almost her brother had been.
You said the Reverend Mother in your school wasn't too keen on having you back.
Well, no, she wasn't, because she said they never before had had a girl who had been in jail, whose mother was in jail. They didn't exactly approve of it. And that it would be also, she said, that it would be hard on me because all the others at my table above all, practically every one of them had somebody fighting in
the British Army.
In the British Army at the time in the war. And that it might be rather uncomfortable for me.
And was it?
Well, anyhow, I didn't go back. When my mother heard this, actually, she didn't want to send me back. She wanted to send me to a school.
An Irish school.
It wouldn't be like that. But I said, no, I loved the school and I wanted to go back to it. And when I went back, the girls couldn't have been nicer. Couldn't have been nicer.
For quite some time, Sheila Humphreys had wanted to become actively involved in the struggle. On the grounds of age and immaturity, her mother had opposed this. But eventually, her mother's opposition caved in.
I joined Ranelagh branch of Cumann na mBan, where Phyllis Ryan, who only died quite recently, she was captain and a lovely person. She was, and I was very, very, very happy in Cumann na mBan after that. Of course, everybody was, because this, what they call now solidarity, was something extraordinary. You had a completely new idea of life. It was what you could do for Cumann na mBan, what you could do for Ireland, and nothing else mattered. Nothing else.
It was suggested that in Cumann na mBan, you weren't interested in developing the members as women.
Well, that's quite true. I don't think we were.
Even though there were suffragettes on the other side of the,
yes.
the Irish Sea?
Yeah.
That wasn't a priority?
No. I have to admit that it wasn't at that time. The one priority was to get our freedom.
Do you think the IRA gave Cumann na mBan the recognition it deserved?
Well, of course, we never were looking for credit for that. That wouldn't have entered anybody's mind in those days, because both the men themselves and the girls were so full of idealism that I think those kinds of things would never enter their minds.
But did you not want to be more actively involved?
Well, we couldn't have been more actively, actually, as it was. What more did we want? And as I say, on the...
But strategy, policy, plans?
Well, the plans were practically the same all the time until they decided that they'd go more leftish, if you like. And then they did invite us to their convention.
But De Valera didn't approve of using women on active service.
No, he did not.
What was he like?
He certainly didn't. Well, of course, in those days, again, we worshipped the ground he walked on. We thought he was the greatest leader that had ever been sent us, because he had, I think in a way, he had that remoteness about him that they say Parnell had, that probably attracted people even more than if he had been very friendly with everybody. And... we just thought, look at the, you know, the story of when he went down to, in 1923, when he went down to Ennis for the first time after he'd been released, and there was an attempt, definitely, I think, an attempt on his life, and there again, it was a woman, Barrett, wasn't it, Polly Barrett, who threw herself between the soldiers and him in case a bullet would get him.
So he was worshipped.
He was. He was.
Do you still worship him? Or the memory of him?
I still worship the memory I had at that time of him. Yes.
Did he live up to the image?
No. No, not when Paddy McGrath was executed. I could never completely forgive him for that.
But that was much further up the road. The Humphreys supported De Valera in the Civil War. Their house in Aylesbury Road was a safe house, often used to shelter fugitives. But eventually the house was raided. There was a shootout and Sheila Humphreys found herself under arrest and in prison. Immediately she went on hunger strike. She remembers at that time Countess Markievicz helping to keep up the spirits of the fasting prisoners.
She was only arrested, we were probably on about 18 or 19 days when she came in, so there was no sense in her going on strike because, well, we'd either be dead or released by the time she'd get anywhere near us. Yeah. So, but she came in and kept us all. She'd go from bed to bed and keep us so entertained with her stories of her youth and everything. She was a wonderful raconteur, as you can tell everything.
Well, what's the background to the hunger strike?
Well, the background to the hunger strike, I suppose, from your point of view, you'd say, because, I mean, the peasants say that the women only follow the men. The men decided that there were 15,000 at that time interned for no reason, good, bad or indifferent, and that they couldn't go on with that forever. And the conditions were very, very bad in both Kilmainham and Mountjoy, and they decided they'd go on a hunger strike and end one way or another. And then Frank Aitken was blamed very much for so many going on hunger strike, because he said by the time when he heard they were going on hunger strike, he sent out a statement saying that the army would be behind them, and by that time it would probably be so widespread that they'd have to give in. Well, a lot of the camps then decided that that was an incentive to go on strike. But really, if one read it, he didn't mean that. He did, because nobody ever from the outside ever ordered the men to go. And certainly Frank Aitken didn't. But then they went on, and then two of their men died, and they realised that it would only be a slow death for so many more. And they decided to call it off. But at least they paid us. Well, they went to all the different jails, and they sent Tom Derrick, and the old man, I've forgotten his name, round. They gave him a car to go, and he came round towards. There were only seven of us by this time. Yes, the authorities did a very mean thing with the women. We were 15 days on strike when they got a message was sent round that we were all to be released that day. The women were all being released. And they said, what, did we want to order taxis? Did we want to, what time would we like to go? And so on. And my aunt was in with me at the time in the North Dublin Union. And we decided we'd be home in time for the evening meal so that we'd get the taxi at 5 or 6. That was grand. Everything was great. They started making tea in every one of the dormitories and all the different tea. And they asked me. I said, I've been so long now, I think I'll wait till I get home. I'd rather. And my aunt said the same, unfortunately. And at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, word came back from the gate that only those who had broken their fast would be allowed out. In other words, only those who had taken tea. And of course, nearly all had taken tea. And it was a trick so that they could say in the papers next day, the women have given in. All the women had given in. I think that was one of the dirtiest tricks the Free State played that time. I really do. And so here we were, had to go back again. And we were 15 days that time, and we didn't get out till we were 31 days on hunger strike. Another 15 days.
So you were 31 days on hunger strike.
31 days on hunger strike.
And how did that feel? Did you think you were going to die?
Not at all. I was quite
too tough.
No, because you really, after about the 14th or 15th day, we didn't go around much. We stayed in bed a lot.
Conserving
energy and read books. And above all, read any book that had a lot about food in it. We loved that. And we had one wonderful girl from Cork. I think Margaret O'Brien, I think was her name. She wrote down to her sister to send up her best cookery book. She was on hunger strike. And every day at about lunch hour, she'd say, now, girls, we're going to have a four-course lunch. And she'd read out first a hors d'oeuvre or soup or something and go through the whole thing. Every day she had a different thing for us.
So
and
you're
we enjoyed
eating in your imaginations.
Yeah.
Sheila Humphreys and Cumann Amon seem to have retained their sense of humour even in the middle of their hunger strike. But at one point they did lose it. That was when O'Casey's The Plough and the Stars was put on at the Abbey. Cumann Amon staged a public protest.
The one thing in that play was bringing the Republican flag unfurled into the public house. That was never done. And when you bring a flag like that, we'd have easily put up with her. That was part of life. But it certainly was not part of life to bring an unfurled report.
And the effect it was having on families?
Well, I think he was a very... a man who had an insight into everything. He summed up the people and the different shades of republicanism in a wonderful way. I mean, we could enjoy O'Casey if it was Republicans looking at it, but when you saw the others gloating over the faults of Republicans, but he did, oh, he was wonderful.
For many people, the Civil War was the great tragedy of the early part of this century. So what does Sheila Humphreys think? She was part of it. Was Civil War inevitable?
Look what we got in the end. It wasn't a change. The country that was built up after Free State and still there, it's not Connolly's idea of what we fought for. We fought for real, real equality for everybody. There's still the very same distinction between the people who have and the people who have not.
But not all the members of Cumann Amon saw it that way, did they?
Well, I suppose... perhaps not. No, I suppose, to be honest, they didn't. A lot of people, not only the women but the men, thought, get freedom first and then let's decide, which was a very dangerous policy altogether. But they did say that this would only make trouble, make another division again. But it was much better it would have been if we had that division long ago, from the very time after 1916. It was a desperate tragedy looking back on it, because we lost the North to the Civil War and we lost the language to the Civil War, because there were just as many people on the Free State side who wanted to see an Irish-speaking Ireland as there were on the anti-treaty. And that was one of the real tragedies. Well, the two tragedies, the North and the language, went. But it's easy now with hindsight to say that anything should have been done to avoid it. But at the time, I'm afraid it was inevitable.
There was bound to be a civil war.
Absolutely.
You've talked about the great idealism of your youth and what all your friends and many of your relatives seem to be struggling for. And now we have our independence. We have our own Irish government. Are you satisfied?
Not at all. How could I be satisfied? I tell you, we still haven't any of James Connolly's ideas of what the country was going to be like. Well, until one thing, we'll have to have education for all, the same kinds of education for all. That's the beginning, because from the very start, the children who have are put into one school, the children who haven't are put into another. So straight away there's inequality.
Socialism is what you want.
Absolutely. Out and out.
Well, you've lived a very full life, and in many senses you seem to have been disappointed, but you seem to be still a very happy and contented person.
Well, I suppose that God gave me that nature, maybe. I don't think I have much to do with that. You either are or aren't, but I am. I've had a very, very happy life and very interesting life.
And what would be your hopes for the Ireland of the future?
That we will see a socialist Ireland and an Irish-speaking Ireland sometime.
And that was Sheila Humphreys, a woman who is part of our history and who still retains the deep commitment she showed over...